Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
And we've of course been telling stories and trying to understand the personal aspect of the Holocaust, because when we do look at 6 million, it's just almost an overwhelming number. And I guess that the way in which we do it is we take personal stories and we try and understand what it meant to families and what it meant and what it still means to this day. Dr. David Silberklang is a senior historian. He's an International Institute for Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem. Good morning and thanks for joining us. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Thank you. Remembering and commemorating like you.
Absolutely. Of course, it's a very difficult balance. And I asked one of our guests earlier, you know, when people talk about something being a billion light years away, it's meaningless to me. I don't know what one light year is. I don't know what a billion is. To some extent, the talking about 6 million has that kind of maybe danger built into it. How do we deal with that?
Well, as you were just saying, we need to look at the individual stories, but not stay. That helps us get the insight into what people were experiencing and what it meant to be a Jew during the Holocaust and the whole context. But we can't get stuck only in the personal stories, because then the Holocaust becomes one large human interest story, and we have to know how to expand out, kind of a zoom out effect once we've zoomed in, and then you can grasp more of what this enormity is. It's not 6 million, it's one times 6 million.
I like that way of looking at it. Yeah, one times 6 million. I think it gives it is a nice way of explaining. And I like the zooming out and the zooming in, because we do need to constantly do that. If we don't do that, we need the perspective from a distance, but we also need the personal stories, otherwise it's meaningless.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, people who've been, for example, to Yad Vashem's History Museum, What we tried to do in planning that museum when it opened, it's not so new anymore, 17 years ago, was to have that effect. I mean, you know, the extent of our success in that is in the eyes of the beholder.
Sure.
But we tried to highlight individual and small group stories, families or other kinds of groups and individuals, and then put that in the context in each section of the museum, in the context of the larger story that that section is telling. And we feel that that gives that sense. That's also why we talk to survivors of the Holocaust. The idea of bringing survivors in to talk to groups, school groups, adult groups, all sorts of people, is because they have that insight that none of us has, unless you were there. We can only begin to approach. But that personal contact also gives us some kind of a personal context within which we can then begin to understand the larger picture.
Mm. Jonathan Sacks writes in Morality, he writes about the fact that we don't call, and we never have spoken about victims, Holocaust victims. It's Holocaust survivors, people that were real survivors, looked forward in their lives, rebuilt their lives, and very often only became comfortable telling their stories later on in their lives, once it was almost their lives had been rebuilt and more established. Do you see a lot of that at Yad Vashem in terms of your Holocaust survivors?
We have many Holocaust survivors who tell that kind of a story. I didn't talk about it until, and they will give a certain point. Some will say, until my children grew up and began to ask questions, you know, in the late 1960s or 1970s, or until I encountered Holocaust denial, or until I met people who knew nothing, and I realized I have to say something about it, otherwise the story will go away. But we also know that actually there were survivors who told their story, not just among themselves, but beyond. Even in the latter part of the 1940s, there were lots of memoirs that were published, for example, then. And in Israel, throughout the 1950s already, every year around Yom HaShoah, the newspapers carried personal stories of survivors. In Israel, the turning point, the critical mass was reached first with the Eichmann trial, where more than 100 survivors gave their personal accounts. And those accounts were not only, and then I picked up a gun and I shot lots of Germans, most of those accounts were of all the different kinds of experiences that we know. And what was interesting is that people in Israel, there was no television in Israel then, there was only radio, and people were listening to the radio all day through their work day. And we know there are photographs of mechanics working on cars in their garage, fixing an engine while listening to the trial, and all sorts of people. And the courtroom was not a regular courtroom. They had to rent a larger space in the convention center in Jerusalem so that many people could come because there was so much interest. And that says something, that people were already wanted to hear the story, and there were survivors who were prepared to tell the story even then. But yes, we find that a whole generation went by in terms of time before there was it really became a widespread phenomenon.
One of the negatives about living in a place like South Africa is that our community here is very much a European Ashkenazi-based community. Recently, we had the privilege of my son marrying a girl from a Yemenite family in Israel, and in the last couple of weeks, we were there for the wedding, and it struck me that many of our cultural Ashkenazi roots have the Holocaust very much embedded in it, whereas Mizrahi Jews or Jews from other parts of the world don't have the same. They've got other terrible experiences, of course, and other challenges, but they don't have this. How does this manifest in Israel?
That's an interesting question. I would say it's a kind of a mixed thing, and it really depends on the individual and the individual's family background and other, you know, who the person's friends are, you know, other cultural, social factors. The Holocaust cuts across all of society, and we know that the Jews of North Africa were directly impacted in Algeria, Morocco, Libya, Tunisia, directly impacted. And what saved them was the fact that the Western allies took over those areas before the Germans could succeed in doing the full plan. They did put many thousands of Jews into forced labor camps, and quite a few of them died, especially in the Libyan camps. They sent small numbers off to camps in Europe with the intention of killing them, but they didn't have time because that was an early Allied victory before the Germans and their local helpers, who were mostly Vichy French local helpers, could complete the job. And we know that the Germans planned to break through the British defenses in Egypt at El Alamein and then go into the Middle East. And they had a murder unit already training in the summer of 1942, ready to go into the Middle East and kill the Jews of Mandatory Palestine and the rest of the Middle East. And they thought that they would have local collaborators. Luckily, we'll never know if they would have succeeded in that or not. So it impacted all those people. And what we find is that there's quite a bit of identification with that. And we also now know that quite a few North African Jews are recognized as survivors of the Holocaust. And
interesting.
Get whatever they're supposed to get from the government as a result of that.
Right. Absolutely fascinating. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I do need to leave it there. It is 8:31. Dr. David Silberklang, Senior Historian, International Institute for Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem. Thank you for spending the time to speak to us. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning.